Good morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Edwin Scarborough, the defendant in the Superior Court. This is about the entry of a plea in the Superior Court that went bad. This case was remanded to the Superior Court for further fact findings, and it is now here back from remand for the Court to review the Superior Court's fact findings. In the Court's original opinion, the Court observed that Superior Court's own rule 11E2 requires that if a plea agreement has been reached by the parties, the Court shall, on the record, require the disclosure of the agreement in open court or on a showing of good cause in camera at the time the plea is entered. The Court also, in its initial opinion, has observed that this requirement will greatly reduce the potential for after-the-fact confusion. More importantly, by spending the time necessary to reduce an agreement to writing, the parties can obviate the necessity for holding a hearing to determine whether an agreement exists and its terms, thereby saving several days of a judge's and the party's time. Here we are in another day, says, trying to resolve, says, what happened with this plea agreement. And the differing part, the parties differing Rashomon-like view of, says, this agreement that was not reduced to any type, says, of writing at the time it should have been by Superior Court rule. The Court observed that this rule, following this rule, reduces the potential for after-the-fact confusion. After this,
Mr. O'Donnell, getting to this case, in Rashomon there were three versions of so-called reality. Are there three here?
I'm wrong. There are two.
Right. What if we were to overturn the result reached by the trial court on remand? What would be the rule of law that any such result would have to rest upon?
The rule of law?
Specifically the facts of this case.
The facts of the case? The court did not follow the rule, and the obvious reason for the rule was borne out by the rule, Superior Court's rule, that the plea agreement shall on the record, the court shall on the record require the disclosure of the agreement in open court. The parties did not disclose the agreement in open court.
Yeah, but I don't see why you would say the court didn't follow the rule. One of the things that's been most troubling in this case from the very beginning is that two officers of the court, two members of this bar, knew there was an agreement and represented to the Superior Court there was no agreement, no other agreement. And then when the agreement, however anybody understood it, wasn't consummated, came back into the court and had this person sentenced as a habitual offender, I don't see how you can say the court didn't follow the rule when two officers of the court misrepresented the facts to the judge.
I wasn't trying to personalize it as to the trial judge. I guess I was speaking of the court as a corporate body, which included the counsel.
I don't see how you can lay anything at the court when two officers of the court misrepresented the facts.
It's possible under these circumstances the trial judge on remand could have said, taken a look at this situation and said, you were required to disclose this agreement to me.
Well, isn't that a fact?
Yes, that's a fact.
They should have, these two officers of the court, two members of the Delaware Bar, should have told the court what was going on.
Well,
is that true?
That is correct. The trial court could have on remand. You should have disclosed this to me beforehand. Now I'm looking at a real mess trying to reconstruct this 2 years before, and I've been asked on remand says to do it, and this is a mess.
Well, Mr. O'Donnell,
and we're not following.
I agree with that last statement, but we're now talking. We're now delving back into history. The two officers of the court, as Justice Holland pointed out, should have disclosed the side agreement. They didn't do it. we had to reverse, the case is remanded, it's now back up before us, and I'm asking, what did the court do wrong?
What did the court do wrong? Well, I'm not trying to project as blame in the court because I personally sympathize with the court looking at this situation, the court trying to make sense of it and trying to reconstruct it and trying to, and it was unfair to the trial court to, you know, put the trial court in this position. However, what we have here is a situation that the court didn't do anything wrong, but there were errors in the trial court's decision on remand.
What were they?
The errors were, as a matter of substantial evidence, findings of fact, if the transcript of this hearing is scrutinized, it's evident that, unlike Rashomon, each side's story can be reconciled and was correct.
Do we have to overturn a finding of fact on remand?
Pardon me?
You're asking us to overturn a finding of fact on remand?
Well, yes, because there isn't substantial evidence.
Which finding is erroneous? Would you have us overturn?
Yes. Yes. Because if you look at the situation, and Mr. Howard honed in on his cross-examination of the Officer Hake, it's in pages 81 through 84 of the hearing.
I don't mean to be too intrusive, Mr. O'Donnell, but just tell us the finding of fact that you contend was erroneous and has to be overturned.
The finding of fact was that there wasn't any agreement in the, it says the plea agreement. And
if I understand it, it was evolving. And what we have is one agreement to cooperate with the police, and the focus was, according to the defendant, on Dover. Then we have a suggestion from the police officer that he wanted help in Woodside. Then the defendant said, I can't help you in Woodside, that's too dangerous. And then the trial judge said there was no agreement per se, but it was a work in progress, so to speak, back and forth. And then there was an offer to help in Dover, and the police said, well, that offer is not good enough. And then at some point in time, the defendant also says, all I had to do was present evidence against my co-defendants and be willing to do that, and that was it. So the question is, consistent with Justice Jacobs' observation, is there a factual finding in the record that there ever was an agreement? And what was the agreement, and what is it that the defendant did not do?
Well, there's a factual finding in the record that, in a sense, there was no agreement with respect to what was actually written in the plea. The court's...
Which is the foundation for the reversal, you're saying the court...
Exactly. The parties agreed that the quid pro quo was that Mr. Scarborough would obtain this plea and the benefit of the state's recommendation if he agreed to testify against his co-defendants in another separate burglary case and complied with substance abuse treatment. That was the agreement. The court on remand found that that was essentially an illusory agreement, that it wasn't an agreement because, the court said, as if Mr. Scarborough had a choice if the state subpoenaed him to testify. Well, that was manifestly wrong because the defendant was providing a consideration. He was waiving his Fifth Amendment right not to testify in a proceeding where he was a defendant. So where the court said that there was no agreement, that it was illusory, what was on the plea agreement here, the written plea agreement, didn't mean anything, that was error. Secondly, says the court found that there was an agreement that was enforceable, but that was the other agreement that was off the record. And we believe also that the court's fact findings were wrong, says about that. And the court in the state, the trial court in the state, focused on many, many collateral agreements and side agreements and negotiations and this and that, but the real focus was, and Mr. Howard says focused on it during, says, the hearing, was what happened within days of the entry of the plea on September the 15th. Laying all else aside, what happened was Ms. Dean had a letter from Mr. Scarborough, and Mr. Scarborough offered to turn over or to set up four or five specifically named individuals for the police. And so she took that as to the prosecutor. Prosecutor put his blessings as on it. They worked out as the plea, which didn't reflect this, just entered the plea, and he specifically agreed to do that. That was his offer. It was taken to the state.
Is that what she wrote in her letter that she sent to his brother by mistake?
No, I think that was previous.
An earlier.
That was part of the ancillary agreement, kind of like negotiations. But the real agreement was that he would identify these specific people. And she took that to the state. The state put its blessing on it. He detrimentally relied on it, says entered his plea. Then, within days, they contacted each other. And if we look at both the cross-examination of Officer Hake and the defendant's own testimony, they can be reconciled. What happened was the defendant made an offer to set up these four or five specifically named individuals, and Officer Hake, it's evident from his direct, all of his testimony, specifically his cross-examination, said that related to Mr. Scarborough, that wasn't satisfactory. I need you to do something else. This is serious. We need you to do some other stuff. Mr. Scarborough says they wanted me to go down to Woodside to deal with people I don't know. That's dangerous. That's not what I agreed to do. Even from Officer Hake's testimony, that can be, says, reconciled.
So up to this point, I need some clarification of whether we're still in the first claim of error or a different one. What I understand you to be saying is that the court's finding of the nature of the agreement was erroneous, because what the court found is that the side agreement, if any, was that Scarborough would give testimony in another proceeding. That was illusory because Scarborough was legally required to do that anyway.
Yes.
And then you're going on and saying that what the court should have found, factually, was that the agreement, that is Scarborough's agreement, was to essentially give up five people in the Dover area?
Correct.
That he detrimentally relied on that. That's all one argument, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, how does that fit into page 2 of the opinion that was attached to your supplemental memorandum, and where the trial judge quotes the prosecuting attorney's testimony to the effect that the deal was to do work? And then the court goes on for a paragraph saying basically nothing was done. But when we're talking about a deal to do work, the question then becomes, is it work in Dover, work in Woodside, or work with the co-defendant?
That's correct. Much of the state's testimony that the trial courts has relied on was either it wasn't testimony, because it was essentially, if you look at the whole body of work, it was leading questioning and also opinion offered by its witnesses rather than fact. It was, my opinion was, and there are several references to it, my perception of the deal was that, such, or my opinion was. Well, that's not, you know.
What I find confusing from an appellate point of view is the judge continues in the next paragraph that I just read to you, where it says, the state says, the deal was to do work.
Mm-hmm.
And then the trial judge on remand says, whatever the deal was, if there even was a deal, you didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to let you withdraw your plea. But then in a footnote, the trial judge says, and anyway, you knew what was happening when you pled guilty. How does that fit together logically?
Well, I'm reluctant to be harsh on the decision itself, but we contend that there are errors in it, that it is logically inconsistent. The court is, in a sense, saying, the trial court is, in a court sense, saying, look, as if there were a deal, as if there were an agreement, and saying that, you know, this agreement, there is no agreement, but at the same time enforcing something that wasn't the agreement. No doubt the trial court took a dim view of Mr. Scarborough, and we believe that was unwarranted based upon what was required to be decided, as in this record, the trial court, well, in fact, at page 2, the court said, assuming an agreement. So the trial court right away jumped to the skepticism that there was an agreement, which was crucial, it says here. We're talking about the agreement, says, which was, that is the agreement that the trial court was asked to address. And the trial court said, assuming an agreement.
Well, there's another piece of this, too, isn't there? And that is the position that was taken by Scarborough in his testimony that, yes, I agreed to do work, but that was only in connection with getting, being freed on probation. It didn't have anything to do with the agreement of the state not to seek a habitual offender status.
Well, that
and all the other witnesses at the hearing were arrayed against him, including Scarborough's own attorney. Isn't that why the trial judge said, Mr. Scarborough, I just don't credit your testimony?
Well, they were arrayed against him, but they were arrayed against him insofar as opinion. And that can be reconciled, says, too. Now, the trial court kind of scoffed at that, and the state scoffed at that, he was concerned about getting out. But anyone who's represented a criminal defendant says knows that their primary focus is getting out. They think that it's realistic that Mr. Scarborough that morning when he entered the plea was thinking about, and this collateral fact to everyone else was important to him. The state moved to reduce his bail. At that time, they asked that he be, says, released. That was what was important to Mr. Scarborough. It was far more important than any writing, says, in the plea agreement. So, he was misled. That's a realistic quid pro quo. He was let out to work.
Two quick questions.
Yes.
Is it, looking at this case from 30,000 feet, is it fair to say that your claim of error amounts to one contention, which is that the court made a critically erroneous fact finding?
Yes.
That's basically your sole argument. And second question is, doesn't your position boil down to the proposition that the court erred essentially in not crediting the testimony of Mr. Scarborough?
No, because everyone's testimony can be reconciled here. And that it is an error, not crediting the testimony of Mr. Scarborough, because his testimony was consistent with the state's testimony. Unfortunately, it was never, says, reduced to any type of writing or never discussed 2 years beforehand, as it should have been. And we faced what the court described as a litigation accident waiting to happen. This is more like a train wreck that the trial court was trying to put on it back on its tracks. It's a situation where, I'm working without a net here, but I just thought last night of the equitable situation. I know two members of the court presided on the Court of Chancery, so I'm taking a big risk here. But, for instance, in a real estate transaction, statute of frauds question, if there's an oral agreement to convey property, if there's no writing evidencing a conveyance of real property, there's a real problem. We don't say, that's a problem, but let's hear the testimony of the parties to try to reconstruct this agreement. We almost had that situation here. In addition, it's just this thing. This agreement would not be upheld, I don't think, in civil terms. If this were a civil case, if you had a, if we had a failed exchange of a case of Dr. Pepper based on the terms of this agreement, a trial court would not assess damages. And it's what happened here on remand, and the consequences illustrate aptly the reason for rule.
Well, if you were to sum up the Superior Court judges in ruling in one sentence, it would be, beginning with the quotations around outside oral agreement, close quote, that there couldn't have been an outside oral agreement because whatever outside oral agreement there was, A, no one told me about it in the first instance, it isn't disclosed in writing, and third, even to the extent I could believe what anyone said in front of me, it was so imprecise as to be unenforceable. And because it's unenforceable, it can't really be an agreement. That's the trial judge's opinion on remand, isn't it? begrudgingly dealing with the issue we sent back to him on the theory there wasn't an agreement at all, and then saying, well, even if there was one, because it was so imprecise, it's not enforceable, therefore there wasn't one. That's the essence.
I wish I could say it that concisely and aptly. That's our position, Your Honor, that that's what the trial court should have said.
Hopefully Mr. Williams will address that perspective.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. The Superior Court conducted an evidentiary hearing after the remand from this court on May 22nd of last year. At that hearing, Mr. Scarborough, as well as the prosecutor, Mr. Scarborough's former legal counsel, public defender Sandy Dean, and Corporal Hake, who's a Delaware State police officer, all testified. The trial judge who had accepted the plea had the opportunity to hear all of these witnesses and made what the state contends is appropriate factual findings given the evidence that was presented. Mr. Scarborough had an opportunity to testify at this remand hearing about what his understanding of all of this was, and his contention was that his possible assistance to Officer Hake had actually nothing to do with the prior written agreement or the possible sentence. Now, the state's position, which was confirmed by the public defender's testimony, was that, no, the side agreement that's been referred to related to the possible sentence or at least sentence recommendation that the state was going to make, and most specifically whether or not the state was going to file an habitual offender petition regarding Mr. Hake. He had three prior felony convictions, and this would have been a fourth felony conviction, making him habitual criminal eligible.
Mr. Williams, yes, just one question. Do you agree with the statement of the issue as phrased by the other side? That is that essentially there's one claim of error here, and that is that the judge made a critical or material error of fact or finding of fact regarding the essence or nature of the agreement. Or
well,
is there some other issue? Is there some other claim that you're responding to? I mean, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page here.
Yes. No, I don't know that it needs to go beyond that. I mean, I think if this court's content to look at the factual findings and the standard of review is simply whether or not those factual findings are based on competent evidence, and if they are they clearly erroneous, and do they reflect a logical and orderly deductive process? And the state submits that certainly they do, that the factual findings are correct. The trial.
What did the court find on remand? First, did the court find that there was an agreement? And second, if the answer is yes, what was the agreement?
Well, I think the court went through the testimony and ultimately concluded after reviewing at least Mr. Scarborough's testimony, who testified actually after the other three witnesses, at least on direct, that his version of what the agreement was not credible, and that ultimately...
I want to know what's described for me in a sentence. If the court found there's an agreement, so that first you'd have to say yes.
Yes.
The Superior Court on remand found that there was an agreement, and if the answer is yes, then it is. And here's the agreement that the court found.
Okay, I think the agreement was that Mr. Scarborough would be released on unsecured bond. He was to work with Corporal Hake in assisting in drug investigations, and that if he did such work and that the work was satisfactory to the state would do one of two things, or perhaps both things, make a favorable recommendation at sentencing, because Mr. Scarborough had not been sentenced at this time. He was awaiting the pre-sentence investigation. And secondly, if the work was, very satisfactory in the state's view, that they would also refrain from filing the habitual criminal petition against Mr. Hake. excuse me, against Mr. Scarborough if the assistance to Mr. Hake was appropriate.
Now, what you said is very clear. My difficulty is finding it anywhere in the opinion.
Yes,
on remand. You agree that would be difficult to find in any one place?
I don't think it's stated that precisely at all. And there are some segues. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Following up on Justice Holland pinpointing what's frankly been troubling me, at the bottom of page 3 in the opinion, after several instances of putting outside agreement and agreement in quotes, inferring that there really never was one, despite the fact there was a remand telling the trial judge to make findings about what it was, because both parties had conceded there was one here, the trial judge seems to reach the conclusion that to the extent there was any agreement at all, A, it wasn't an outside agreement, and B, it can be found only in the plea agreement, because he says, notably, of course, any such, and again in quotes, agreement, close quote, inferring that there never was one, to testify truthfully was not outside the plea agreement at all. It was specifically noted in the plea agreement. Now, I'm very confused. Here's a trial judge who has a remand, who's told that counsel for both sides have conceded that there's an outside plea agreement, and he's instructed to take findings on what that outside plea agreement was, who consistently throughout the remand opinion disparages the existence of an outside plea agreement and finds that to the extent there was an agreement, it was in the plea agreement specifically, and it was not, quote, outside the plea agreement at all. Now, what do we make of that? Is the rest of the opinion, given that, just window dressing, and does it amount to anything more than saying, well, even if there were, hypothetically, a plea agreement, and I'm doing this remand on a hypothetical, the terms were so illusory that it was unenforceable, and therefore there was no contract at all. Which way? What is he deciding?
Well, I think what he's deciding is
Or just to add one another possibility to the Chief Justice's question, could he have found that the even if the terms weren't illusory, whatever they may be, it is clear that Mr. Scarborough never performed them?
Well, I think certainly the bottom line is that he never performed them, and even if there was an agreement, there wasn't performance, so you don't have the exchange.
Tell me why I alone, not necessarily the court, should have confidence in findings of fact on the terms of an outside plea agreement when the writer of the opinion tells me there was no agreement outside the plea agreement itself. I just don't follow that.
Well, I think what the trial judge was doing, and perhaps he should have stated it explicitly, was that he was taking the version testified to by Mr. Scarborough at the remand hearing. And Mr. Scarborough's testimony was pretty specific, and he was asked very direct questions about this. You know, what was the agreement? And he says, well, the agreement was just what's written there in the plea agreement, that there really isn't any outside agreement. The agreement is I'm to do two things. I'm to testify truthfully against these two co-defendants in a casino robbery, and I'm to submit to the drug testing and treatment. And that was all that Mr. Scarborough contends was the agreement. So I think the judge is saying, okay, I'm going to accept that from your position, and then I'm going to evaluate that. And that's what I think he's trying to do. But at the same time, the trial judge also has, and he describes it as the diametrically opposed testimony of the other witnesses as to what this additional agreement was.
But that goes back to Justice Holland's point earlier when he was describing the prosecutor's own testimony. And even the trial judge says the prosecutor testified, and now I'll put quotes around the trial judge's word, unequivocally, that the deal was to do work helpful to the police. That's not in the plea agreement.
No, I think that's true.
So how could you come to the conclusion that the only agreement there was in the written plea agreement itself, and that this agreement of counsel on appeal that there was an outside plea agreement isn't true, but hypothetically, if it were, I'm going to make the following findings of fact. I mean, maybe it's not important to resolving this, to dealing with the trial judge's evident chagrin at having to conduct a hearing on remand, and in effect chagrin at being criticized for perhaps taking a plea that was incomplete and looked at it as criticism of him, perhaps, rather than criticism of the lawyers who didn't disclose to him, as they're supposed to under the rule, the full agreement between the parties. But how can you say and have confidence in findings that say that the prosecutor said there was a deal outside the plea agreement, the defendant said there was a deal outside the plea agreement, but I don't find that there's a deal outside the plea agreement? I just don't follow that.
Well, it may seem like the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, and I think one of the problems that the trial judge was having with Mr. Scarborough's testimony even was that he seemed to be saying different things at different times.
But well, the judge addresses that in a footnote, too. I mean, in response to the earlier question, you gave a pretty crisp summary of Scarborough's testimony. There were basically two things. And if it was that clear, I would wonder why we'd even be here. But what the trial judge says in footnote two is, if I look at the terms, in quotes, quotations got a lot of use by everybody in this opinion. He says, if I look at the terms stated by the defendant, it's difficult to see a contract enforceable by the defendant. So it wasn't clear to the trial judge that there was anything the defendant could enforce. And yet, if I go back to your earlier answer, where you said he was supposed to do X and Y, if he did X and Y, certain things would happen. And the judge seems to think that's confusing. And then the judge elaborates on that later in the opinion when he says, just because Scarborough was offered an alternative that wasn't acceptable, that doesn't mean it was impossible to perform. Now, putting aside the logic of that sentence, what the trial judge is continuing in the opinion to say is, this was so elusive, I can't tell you if there was an agreement or what it was. All I can tell you is two things. Scarborough didn't do anything, and he knew what he was doing when he pled guilty.
Well, I think that's certainly a fair characterization of what the trial judge's ultimate conclusions were, and that's really the heart of this whole problem, is what exactly was the substance of the agreement. I think the trial judge was trying to say, okay, we're here on remand. I'm going to listen to Mr. Scarborough's account of what he thought the agreement was, if there was or wasn't a side agreement, and I'll analyze that. And that's his starting point here, but at the same time, he says, but I have this diametrically opposed testimony from all the other witnesses, and what they're telling me is that the side or undisclosed agreement was that he would do work, and if the work was satisfactory, then that would help him in terms of an ultimate sentence recommendation and perhaps even to avoid a habitual criminal petition.
Whatever and however way this works out here, it suggests, if it doesn't cry out, that we recommend to the Superior Court that it follow its own rules and insist that when there is an agreement other than, I'm not going to call it an outside agreement for fear it'll end up in the transcript in quotes, but if there is an agreement that's not articulated in writing in a plea agreement, counsel still have an obligation for public policy reasons they don't want to disclose, which is understandable, to go into chambers and make some form of record before the trial judge about that outside agreement. Because it strikes me that a trial judge would listen to an agreement as stated by the prosecutor that the defendant will do work. And the trial judge is going to say, what kind of agreement is that? What's going to happen here is it's going to come back to me, and the public defender or the defense attorney and the defendant are going to say, he did the work. And the prosecutor is going to say, he didn't do the work. Or at least he didn't do the work we wanted him to do. And there'll be a dispute over that. Isn't the best time to resolve that is for the trial judge to say, this agreement that I've just heard about is so illusory that you can forget about it. I'm not going to follow any recommendation because you're just inviting litigation with that kind of illusory or inelegant or whatever phrase you want to use, obfuscation, that the defendant's going to go out and do work. Isn't that what the trial judge would say? And isn't the rule in place to help prevent this kind of chaos from occurring?
Well, I certainly agree. That's the whole purpose of the rule. And had that been done and everything been pinned down from the get-go, perhaps none of this would have ensued.
But was there a downside to this? Is this either too elaborate because the Superior Court doesn't have enough judges and enough time, or prosecutors and defense attorneys don't have enough time to nail down these agreements, or keeping them secret is so important that there's no alternative other than to have a word-of-mouth agreement that later ends up in a factual dispute? I mean, what am I missing here? Why is this difficult?
Well, I don't know that these aren't alternatives that can't be pursued, and I think certainly when we're going to do these plea agreements, if there's anything additional, it needs to be pinned down. I think at the last argument we talked about, the better way to have done this, obviously, was, okay, if your agreement is you're going to set up contraband drug buys with one, two, or three people, specify how many, what the time frame is, and then everybody will know whether or not that contract has been fulfilled. Difficult to hear was the offers. There were counteroffers when one offer was being rejected, and it seemed like the whole thing just kept evolving and kept evolving.
Well, but it was compounded by what the Chief Justice infers in his question, or stated explicitly in his question. It wasn't nailed down. If the prosecutor, as he testified, had said, the agreement is to do work, no one would have left the room until, as you said, there was details. But what happened was, at best, if the agreement was to do work, everybody left with this vague do work agreement. And then what we see is he's asked to work in Woodside. And he said, no, I'll only work in Dover. And they said, well, we want you to work in Woodside, not Dover. And he said, well, that's dangerous for me to work in Woodside. Then he comes back with several names for Dover. And he's told, well, those names don't help us any. That's not good enough. So over a period of what appears to be 13 months, we have this agreement to do work as a work in progress, don't we?
Well, I think that's true, and I think that's the problem, and that's how these proposals are usually made. That Mr. Scarborough's problem was the state had a videotape confession, as his former attorney pointed out, and there wasn't much that she could do for him other than, I guess, to make a unilateral offer that he would do work. And then from there, it kept evolving as to what the subject of work actually meant in this particular case. It never did, I'm not sure it ever did get firmly resolved, but the trial judge's bottom line decision was, well, even if there was something, it's undisputed by all the parties, including Mr. Scarborough, that he never did anything. So we can't say there was a fulfilled contract in any respect. And that, I think, is the kind of the gist of what the trial judge did here. Record was confusing. It was hard to follow even Mr. Scarborough's testimony. And then there was the opposing testimony of the other witnesses.
Well, the problem here is the work was a moving target. The work was, on the one hand, what Scarborough thought he could do. On the other hand, it's what the state wanted him to do, and the two never came together. I just hope we don't write anything that discourages these kinds of arrangements, because we can see how they would be helpful to law enforcement and perhaps on occasion incidentally helpful to a defendant, but certainly helpful to law enforcement, because it's a rational way to attack drug trafficking. But at the same time, it has to be a coherent way of approaching it. And this case points out far better than any I could put on a bar exam how difficult it is to enforce an agreement under circumstances where no one really understands from day one what that agreement might be or truly is. And it looks like it's being used by one side as a moving target to get work, but then never have to follow through on a promise because the work isn't exactly what they wanted in the first place.
Well, I think that's true. It's kind of a classic example of a failure of a meeting of the minds, and that's the prerequisite for an enforceable contract, and that's the difficulty here. I certainly agree with that.
Where does that put us in view of the first argument where the parties on both sides said there was an agreement? And now at the second oral argument, instead of saying there was an agreement, we're presented with there was no meeting of the minds.
Well, I think the agreement was to do work. The problem was that subject matter ever a valid meeting of the minds or not? And it seems because both parties are having different conceptions of what that entails that perhaps there wasn't. That was the trial judge's, I guess, ultimate conclusion here was that, well, even if I accept everything Mr. Scarborough says, he never did anything, so I can't have an enforceable contract.
Well, even if I accept what counsel said to the Delaware Supreme Court, they were wrong, and the Delaware Supreme Court's wrong because there was no agreement.
Well, he says that too, and I think that's really a reference to what Mr. Scarborough's testimony and version was that the only agreement is what's written down. Thank you, Your Honor.
According to this clock, you have 9 seconds. Anything you can probably deliver in 9 seconds?
There was an attempted agreement, but not an enforceable agreement. I hope.
And
that
I was
the court
wrong. The 9 seconds were 9 seconds overtime. Sorry, Mr. Sorry. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.